And then someone went,
testing, 1, 2.
I can really taste the bacteria.
What's up, John? What's up, John Burton?
1, 2, 3, 4. Why you can't have a best?
Okay, wait. Let me rewind. John, you're right.
Right. I'm just going to play us in a little bit.
When are you going to tell me we're starting?
We started.
Okay. Awesome.
I love this. It's fun being on the other side of the mic. I'm excited about that. It's true.
I know. I actually, it's weird. I actually like getting interviewed too.
Yeah, I don't do it often, but I appreciate getting interviewed, and it's fun, and it's a little bit less stressful, I think.
It's much less stressful.
For me.
Yeah, no, it's much less stressful.
But I promise you I'm easy, so I will be an easy conversationalist, I promise.
Well, okay, so first we should start.
Yes.
You're Wesley Dixon?
Yes, that's perfect.
You are the deputy to the president at Vassar College?
That's correct.
You're the host of Conversations in the Salt Mine?
At the Salt Mine, but close enough.
Okay, great, yes. Tell me your life. Where do you come from?
Yes.
How did you get here?
I love those questions. I came to the Hudson Valley most recently, which was 7.5 years ago, from New Haven, Connecticut.
Okay.
And I loved New Haven. It was my second home, my only home at the time, outside of where I grew up, which I'll talk about in a second. But loved New Haven. It was a city that was in transition when I was there, so it was a cool place to be in New Haven as it became sort of a more chic, cosmopolitan sort of place. And I was there seeing that transition. And before that, though, I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm a Florida boy, and I am a Florida boy through and through. So I go to Florida all the time. I go once a month, probably, if not more. I saw a family in Fort Lauderdale. It is where my heart is.
Is your family okay from the...
Thank you for asking. They're fine. Okay. Broward and Dade counties miraculously had almost no impact at all from the storm of last week, but we're no stranger to hurricanes at all, obviously. And
have you seen one? Have you ever?
Have I seen one? Oh my God, I've lived through many of them.
Oh, really?
Yes, of course. People forget Katrina actually came through South Florida before it went on to New Orleans. So we experienced Katrina first, a much lesser version of Katrina.
Do they really make that
sound? Yeah. And see, it's different now. When I was growing up, technology was a little bit different. So we didn't have like the impact windows and all those kinds of things people have now. We didn't have those growing up. And so we had hurricane shutters, like actual either accordion shutters built onto the house or the huge aluminum slabs you would drill into the wall.
Right.
And so when I was going through hurricanes growing up, they were scary just because of what they were, but they were particularly scary because you couldn't see outside, right? All the windows were closed, so it was dark. There was all this like shattering noises, but not from things breaking necessarily, just from the shutters shaking, right? But you couldn't tell what was going on because it was so dark. So you would open up the doors, open the shutters after the hurricane ended, and there was a moment where you had no clue what you're walking into. And it could be like utter destruction, or it could be, wow, like nothing really happened, or just a couple of tiles in the roof gone.
We got lucky, right?
But you never know. So that was how I experienced them growing up.
Oh, wow.
And now it's a little bit different because people have all kinds of different houses being built, different technologies, so you can sort of at least see outside, so you're not deprived of that sensory experience. But yeah, that's where I'm from. That's how I got here.
And then to Vassar.
Yeah, so I came to Vassar from New Haven because I was working in New Haven, and my sort of super boss at the time, by which I mean not the person I reported to directly, but the person who oversaw a whole institution at the time in New Haven, was recruited to be president of Vassar. And so when she got the job at Vassar, she was building her team. And to my luck, and she might say hers too, she recruited me to be part of her leadership team at Vassar. And I am grateful for it. I didn't know what Vassar was, frankly, before I got the job. I didn't apply or look at Vassar when I was applying to school. I didn't know what the Hudson Valley was. I'm not from the Northeast. I'm not from New York. So this sort of regional sort of moniker meant nothing to me. So it was really sort of a jump into oblivion when I took this job and moved here. But it's been a wonderful thing that I've done. I'm happy to have done it.
So you like it here?
I do.
The Hudson Valley, I grew up here.
Okay.
And I'll tell you one weird thing about the Hudson Valley that I noticed. One weird thing that you noticed.
Okay.
The weird thing I noticed, I actually built a podcast around. There are so many talented musicians per capita here. It's ridiculous.
That is true.
It is ridiculous.
Okay, you said weird. That wasn't the tone I thought you meant, but let me now readjust my thinking for what weird might be.
Or weird to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's a cool watch, by the way.
Oh, thank
what
you.
What is that?
It's a Citizen. A standard Citizen nice. Watch. Nothing crazy. Thank you for noticing it. Weird. Oh, my goodness.
And if you think that's hard, wait till I spring this on you.
Okay.
So you're smart.
I like to think I'm decently smart.
We're not accustomed to smart people on the show. So it's mostly musicians and people,
okay,
and people
I love
crying.
That. Okay. I can be a crier too. I'm a Cancer, so I'm very emotional.
Oh, when's your birthday?
July 18th.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
August 3rd.
Wonderful.
So I knew you were coming. I watched your podcast.
Okay.
I'm like, oh no. And you can curse on here. I'm like, oh shit, this guy's smart.
Gosh.
So I go to ChatGPT. So try to do some good in the world, right?
Okay.
So I go to ChatGPT.
Okay.
And I ask ChatGPT what the 10 biggest problems facing the earth are.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask you to solve them.
Solve them or name them? I thought
solve
you asked me to name the ones they listed.
No, I got them.
I know, but I thought it might be a test for me to see if I knew what they thought the biggest problems were.
Go ahead.
I'm going to let me add some conditions to the game.
Go ahead.
I'm going to try to guess at least 4. I think 10 is very difficult for me to guess, but I'm going to see if I can get 4 of them.
See if you can get 4.
In some form or fashion.
Right.
One, I assume, must be climate change.
That's number 1.
It's number 1. Okay.
Right.
So we're on the money there.
You got ding.
Ding. Number 2, some version of income inequality.
Global inequality.
Global inequality. Okay. Yep. It's difficult because what I might say other than that might be riffed off of inequality, but I'll say some version of hunger and homelessness.
You're 3 for 3. Hold on, I can find it here.
How do they name it? It's a version of that, I'm sure.
It is migration and refugee crisis.
Okay, so different.
Yeah,
what I said.
But they say poverty, climate change.
Yep.
And then they also do global health crisis,
I was going to say a health, maternal mortality, something like that.
All right, so you're 4 for 4.
Okay.
You want to keep going?
I'm getting a little bit out of
4.
I'm getting out of my all depth. Right. Well, I will say something about, I don't know, geopolitical strife, war, something like that.
5 for 5.
Okay.
I'll let you off the hook. Geopolitical instability and conflict.
Got it. That's what meant. Okay.
So,
I got a good number.
Pick a number between 1 and 10.
7.
7. Okay. Let's solve. Ready?
Okay.
Let's solve the migration and refugee crisis since we're
goodness.
Just sitting here. This is what ChatGPT describes it.
Yeah.
Political instability, war, poverty, and climate change are driving mass migrations. Refugee populations face precarious living conditions and uncertain futures.
Yeah.
Solve it, Wesley.
It's difficult. Listen, don't quote me on any of this, although I am on the record saying
I was about to say you're
here,
on a podcast. The whole thing's a quote.
But they're all related, right? I mean, I am no sort of, I'm certainly no migration expert. I'm certainly no geography expert. But I will say, what seems to be the case, both from personal experience, from people I know, and just from the news, is that people migrate not because they necessarily want to. They sometimes have to, right? They're pushed to migrate based on a whole host of factors, whether it is climate change or instability in their region, lack of food, economics, all those kinds of things, right? And so I think the hope would be that we as individuals, we as organizations, we as communities think beyond ourselves in ways that might support helping to create communities elsewhere that make people want to stay, right? That make them feel safe, healthy, loved, a part of their community, where they're from, where they are, where they want to be, so they don't feel the need to sort of move in ways that are out of necessity. Now, if you want to move because you want to, that's different, right? But
right.
if you're moving out of necessity, you would think that collectively governments, organizations, others can think about how to do things both in their own boundaries, right, but outside their boundaries to support sort of an ecosystem that people are happy to be in elsewhere. Abstract, but I think it's a concept that I think could help ground how we think about that kind of work.
I don't think it's abstract at all.
Okay.
I the notion, and I wish we looked at immigration this way, but I think you hit the nail on the head with the first sentence, which is these are not people who want to come
right.
– take a piece of your pie. These are people are who 99% of them are doing it because they have to, and that flips the whole picture. And you're and the then it becomes tricky because now you're trying to be a support system to a population that doesn't want to be here,
right?
And that's emotionally complex.
It's difficult
for everybody.
It's difficult. And I should say, I know you didn't mean any harm by this. I just want to add some language to what you said, which is you said the word take a piece of our pie. And I would add part of the story is more often than not, the data shows that migrants and immigrants add to our pie, actually.
Exactly. Right?
So in fact, I know what you meant.
I was
meant.
Trying to think like
I knew
somebody
what you
that
meant.
Doesn't like migrants.
No, of
would,
course. And then as you said, it made me want to say it. And the truth is, the narrative really should be that migrants and immigrants really help the American pie, if you will, in ways that people don't. They know they don't want to acknowledge it, though.
Right, exactly.
But
right.
that's my perspective, and make of it what you will. I've never gotten your first question about what's weird in the Hudson Valley. Let me think about it. You know, it's hard. I don't know. There's so many things that are different. So, you know, what I think is maybe not weird, but it was an adjustment for me, was to think about the Hudson Valley as a regional place, as opposed to thinking about like whatever city, town, hamlet, village you live in as like the center of your life. For me, at least, I found it helpful to think about my life as sort of a whole region, right? Like I live in the Hudson Valley. I don't live in Wappingers or Poughkeepsie or Kingston or Rosendale only, right? But I live in this region, and all the things in the region I can avail myself of to make my life, right? I think when you live in other places sometimes that are maybe bigger cities, you don't have to think outside of sort of the municipality you live in because there's so much in that municipality, right? But here, it's a whole bunch of small municipalities, right, that in and of themselves may not have everything you want to have offered in your life, right? But when you add them all together, you're like, oh, like actually my life is so much more, or can be so much more, if I see it on a bigger geographical scale. Does that make sense?
Not only does it make sense, it clarifies why you're the deputy to the president of Vassar and I'm not.
Oh my goodness.
Because I had crazy musicians.
Oh my goodness.
All right, we pick number seven. Pick another one.
Number three.
Okay, here we go.
Mm-hmm.
Geopolitical instability and conflict.
Oh my goodness.
This may take us a minute.
Oh, my goodness.
Ongoing wars and civil unrest. What's the answer?
The answer is I don't know, obviously, right? But let's just talk out loud about what we think might be able to help us address some of those things. I think, and this is abstract, and I'm being a bastard person by being a little bit abstract, but I think it's helpful. I do think to the extent that people around the world, can continue to think about, first and foremost, the humanity of others, it makes it very difficult to start to slide into geopolitical conflict, civil war, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's very easy when you sort of make someone out to be something less than human. This is what happened in slavery, right? It was very easy for slave masters and others to feel no guilt about what they did because they didn't see slaves as humans,
right?
Enslaved people as humans. And so in some ways, they felt justified in doing what they did because they were actually just managing and trafficking in subhuman, animalistic kinds of commodities, right? And that was sort of 200, 300 years ago, but I don't think it's much different than how many other conflicts happen now, right? We insert any other group of people against another group of people. I imagine somewhere, whether in their home, in their basement, at the bar, in their community, they talk and think in ways about the other, whoever the other might be, in ways that are dehumanizing, right? Mm-hmm. And it makes it very easy to then make decisions along that pathway that are dehumanizing, right? Whether that means you are committing forms of apartheid or treating people in ways that are just subservient. It's very easy to do that when you don't think they're human. And so I think to the extent that we force ourselves daily to recognize, even when it's difficult, the humanity of someone else, someone we see, someone we don't see, I think that starts to grow into a pattern of behavior and a way of living that makes it difficult to say, you know what, I can't pull that trigger, or I can't deny them this opportunity, or I can't speak about them in that way because they're someone's daughter, mother, son, brother, child, as am I, and I don't want to see them harmed like I wouldn't want to see myself harmed. Mm-hmm. Again, it's abstract, but I think the concept really does make it very difficult to traffic in nasty behavior.
What do you think of this idea?
Yeah.
I think it stems from the difficulty in being benevolent, and I think people format their lives as the path to complete and total happiness.
Yeah,
and until you're complete and totally happy, it's a choice between me giving something, being benevolent to you, or me being benevolent to me.
Yeah.
And nobody's ever completely and totally happy or fulfilled.
Yeah.
So always the drive to be benevolent to me instead of you exists, because we have this thinking that there's always going to be more happiness for me.
We think it's a zero-sum game, but it's not a zero-sum game.
It's not a zero-sum game.
It really isn't. And I think
if you got out of that, it would make it easier for me to be benevolent to you, because I think the absence of benevolence is festers.
Absolutely. A friend of mine who I love dearly, she told me a couple of years ago, and I'm not sure if she had this phrase of her own or if she borrowed it from somebody else, but she said to me, gratitude is the antidote to anxiety.
Yes.
And I've always, since she said it, it stuck with me, and I've always tried to live by that since then.
Yep.
To your point, I think the more you can sort of be explicit about what you're grateful for, who you're grateful for, things that have been done to you that you're grateful for, which is to say you're recognizing that it's not a zero-sum game. Other folks can also experience, have happiness, sort of be appreciated as you can too. It starts to open up our possibilities for how we can live together. And I think that is what ultimately can sort of put a nail in the coffin for many of these sort of broader, more global political conflicts.
Yeah. Because if you can look at it as an individual, as you know, there's enough for me.
Right.
I don't have to be 100% before you are 1%.
Right.
If I can do that as an individual, then you can start to do it as a society. Because as a society, it's even harder.
Absolutely.
So, I would say the Burton-esque approach to it would be approach it as define contentment.
Yeah,
for yourself.
Yeah,
and live in that, and of course, try to improve.
Yeah.
Yourself, but start action at contentment, not saturation.
Exactly. Well, it's funny you said it's true. I think what you said, which is very hard for us to do at a societal level. It's very hard for you to do at an interpersonal level, more or less at societal level. I will say though, I've seen some examples of places in the world. I've been privileged because of my job at Vassar to travel the world in lots of different ways, and one of the places that I work a lot is in Rwanda. In Central East Africa. And I've learned a lot about Rwandan history, Rwandan culture, just from being present there for many, many times. And one of the things that is a societal intervention in at least modern day Rwanda, modern by which I mean post-genocidal Rwanda, is there is a practice of something called Imigongo, which is a nationwide effort to basically stop working, stop doing things, stop being recreational once a month. It's, I think, the first or last Saturday of the month where everybody in the country, everybody does some sort of community service for the first half of that Saturday from whatever, nine to one, right? It doesn't matter if you are on the lower income scale or if you're in the higher income scale, if you live in a very rural village or you live in Kigali in a high rise. On Imigongo every month, people find a way to add value to their collective neighborhood, whether that's restriping the road outside their house, if that is in a city version, whether it's, you know, I could think about things like people are doing collective water gathering if they're in a rural village for their community for the week, whatever it is, right? People around the country have built into their daily or their monthly routine to do Imigongo every day or every month. And I think examples like that are things that on a smaller, whether it's your local community in the Hudson Valley or even at a national level, we can consider as things that start to put societal practices into our lifestyles that do speak to this humanity that I'm talking about, right? It's something that is saying, I am more than myself. I am part of a community. It's my responsibility to add to my community in ways that I can see, others can see, that's consistent and sustained. And if we can think about things that are analogous to that in our own lives, whether it's in our families, whether it's in our, again, our communities, our school boards, whatever, I think over time that continuous, sustained, different, but same valued, like micro level intervention starts to bubble up into more than that, right? And so I think I'm inspired by things like that.
Yeah.
And I hope that in some way we can start to bring those kind of practices into our own lives.
Imagongo?
I'm probably saying it incorrectly, but no, that's how I've come to say it.
Okay. That would heal America.
I think so.
If we just the idea of us all doing the same thing half a day every month,
right,
would but that's a fantastic concept. All right.
Yeah.
So we conquered geopolitical instability.
I don't know how many more I can try to conquer.
We got pick a number. It can't be 3 or 7.
Okay, I'm going to pick number 1.
Okay, here we go. Climate change, environmental degradation.
Yeah.
Rising temperature, extreme weather, sea level rise, loss of biodiversity.
Yeah, it's tough. I had the privilege on the Vassar podcast just a couple weeks ago to interview someone, and the episode's not out yet, so you wouldn't have heard it, but her name is Rihanna Gunright, and she is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. And she, before that, was the key architect of the New Green Deal policy platform that was being pushed a lot in 2020 at that time. And so I learned a lot from her in our conversation. And of course, not everyone sort of adheres to or buys into the New Green Deal. But I think one of the things that Rihanna said that struck me was that one of the key things we have to do to fight climate change is first to tell the truth about climate change. Because I think it is unfortunate, but it is true that people are not often as direct or clear or honest about climate change in their own life or the effects of it that are happening sort of day to day that we can see today, right? Yeah. And so I think it's very difficult to address a problem robustly that you don't acknowledge as being a problem. And so I think that's one of the things we have to do is be honest about that. And then the second thing is, like we just said, I think people can start to make changes in their lives personally. And I know it feels like it's a drop in the bucket, given the scope of the problem, right? But I do think there's a tipping point at which a number of individual local community changes start to make meaningful differences in the world or in some sort of locale, right? And so I think that's one thing. The second thing is, I think we do have to continue to advocate, at least in this country, we have to advocate to our state, local, federal government that they prioritize climate change and sort of play a role in climate change. For example, Rihanna was explaining to me there's sort of a way in which right now we're allowing our private sector in this country to be the engine of change for climate change. That is to say, solar panel development is a private industry, right?
Right.
Geothermal development is a private industry per se. And I don't think Rihanna was advocating that we eliminate the role of private industry in fossil fuel minimization. That said, I think Rihanna did advocate for the public sector, i.e. the federal government or other governments, playing a much more active role in collaborating with private industry to get to the same place. So, for example, right, if you leave it up to private industry to think about where they want to put wind farms or solar mills or whatever they are, right, they probably have different incentives than what might be needed to sort of really address environmental justice or climate change, right? But if our government plays a planning role to say, okay, you all have the technical expertise to be able to implement and establish whatever these interventions are, and we at the federal government have sort of the data, the foresight, the vision to think about where these things might be best placed in our country to be able to have the highest possible impact and still have you make or at least not lose money, let's collaborate on that and let's tell you where you should consider putting these things in ways you might not have thought about otherwise to make a big impact. So I think having a federal or governmental sort of entity that is thinking about their role in that way and is willing to collaborate with the private industry in that way can play a really big deal in helping us address climate change.
Agree.
Yeah.
It's also, it. Whenever I talk about climate change,
yeah,
I always scratch my head at people who debate whether it's man-made or who cares.
Right. Like, it's happening regardless.
Right, right. So A, why get hung up on that? And B, change at that level without economic incentive,
yeah,
probably isn't going to,
right,
isn't going to happen.
Right.
And I wonder why it hasn't happened already. If solar, I wonder why that industry isn't bigger,
right,
than what, and because there's economic incentive,
right,
there's tax relief, there's grants, there's
you know, long-term just energy bill,
right?
Incentive,
right?
And it has. Why hasn't that taken off? What's the economic?
I'm not sure. I think it's. I'm not sure what the economic lack of driver might be. I will say, and this I mean with all love and compassion. I feel like, unfortunately, I'm not sure when folks will hear this, but Hurricane Helene just went through the Carolinas and Georgia, yeah. and as everyone knows, those areas never thought they would be victims of those kinds of natural disasters, right? And
right.
My parents worked in insurance for a very long time, so I'm more knowledgeable about insurance than I ever want to be. but I promise you, the folks in whatever county that is, North Carolina, I actually think I saw. It's not a promise. I think the data showed only 1% of homeowners in that county have flood insurance, right? And so unfortunately, it's likely to be the case that many of those homes that were destroyed will not get coverage despite having homeowners right. insurance. They have no flood insurance, right? That's how the insurance industry works, believe it or not. It's unfortunate. And so I think, unfortunately, the more and more situations like this happen, that becomes economic incentive to think about climate change, right? When people
right.
start to face this brick wall and they're like, oh my goodness, I don't have a home, or I have to put my whole retirement into fixing my home, and I wouldn't think I have to do that. I think that starts to become the narrative that tells policymakers, folks of influence, wow, okay, this is a problem that has no solution built into our system right now. We need to work this a different way.
It's interesting that the nature of humanity is such that it has to happen to you before you could reconsider.
Of course.
Which makes us our own worst enemy, because Absolutely. We can't preempt anything.
Absolutely.
And everything is responsive, which is not
a good
headspace.
No. There are things you have to be reactionary to because you're not going to be able to predict them. But there are many right. things you can be proactive for, as you're intimating. And I think this is one of those things. And I just think we've not turned the corner on that. I mean, for example, you know, I go home to Fort Lauderdale all the time, and it baffles me, in Fort Lauderdale of all places, how many folks I know who don't recycle, for example,
yeah.
right? And I'm like, you are living on the precipice of a place that is like first in line for climate change disaster, unfortunately, right?
Right.
And even in your own headspace, you're not embodying practices that would support maybe mitigating or slowing the effects of climate change.
Right.
It blows my mind. Like there's sort of a dissonance about that, right?
Right.
That doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
But I think it's because people haven't yet experienced the acute effects of that. And so as such, they don't feel like it's a problem that needs imminent solving or imminent behavior change from them.
And or that belief system that, well, you know, climate change is cyclical and has been going on forever. And my response to that is, okay, but there weren't 7 billion people
right.
the last right. time the climate
the world
changed.
Has changed.
Yeah.
Yes, I was somewhere last summer, and it was a foundation that funds a lot of science research, and they're embarking on a new body of work, they're investing more in this body of work around planetary health, climate change, whatever it is, right?
Right.
And I'm going to get this stat wrong. I didn't know I have to say this here, but something to the order of, you know, 15 to 20% of the world's poorest people will just die during climate change, right? I mean, that is sort of the cost of climate change, right? And people, that could be the cost, right?
Right.
If people continue to have sort of a self-centered, not humanistic, not global perspective about climate change, right? There are people who are, of course, the poorest in the world who are the most susceptible to climate change for obvious reasons, right? And if we keep going how we're going, the result is whatever percentage of the folks just die. They just stop living. Population gets smaller,
right?
Which might be sustainable, frankly, but that at a cost that I don't think many folks are willing to pay. If they knew that was the cost, right? I think they might think about it differently and say, oh, wow, like 1/8 of the people around may not be here in whatever amount of time. Like, let's think differently about this, right? And so I do think it is a problem that people have to see or hear, explained in different terms for them to start to think about how they might individually act differently.
You have a lot of clarity. How do you handle your mental health?
I'm happy it seems I have a lot of clarity. And to be honest, I think I do. I take a lot of pride in, well, first of all, what I didn't say was I am an only child. So I am very comfortable being in my own space, in my own thoughts, with myself, being reflective, being observant. And so I say that as a general matter, but I think it does help support, for me at least, a very healthy set of mental health practices, right? I sort of know how to check out, how to look inward, how to be honest about what's going on in my own body, physically, emotionally, mentally, whatever it is, but also recognize how I react or relate to my environment, right? And so that is, I think, a really helpful skill and tool. I will say, I was just at a conference recently, and the topic of youth mental health came up. I don't think I'm in the youth category anymore. Make of that what you will. But it was helpful to be at the conference because the scholar who was talking on this panel made the point to say that mental health is not, and this might not sound intuitive, but I think it's helpful to say, mental health is not the state of being happy or joyous constantly. That's not what mental health is. That's not good mental health, just to be happy all the time.
Correct.
Right? Good mental health is to have, there's two parts she posited. The first is to have an appropriate reaction to whatever situation that you're in, right? And so that could mean that you have a range of emotions, right? You could, the reaction could be mad, happy, frustrated, incensed, ebullient, whatever it is, right? If it's, you know, the appropriate, quote unquote, given situation, right? And the second part is it to have coping mechanisms given whatever that reaction is, right? Mm-hmm. So if the reaction is something that might be perceived as a negative emotion, which I don't really believe in, but a emotion that we might often think of as negative, right? Good mental health is not feeling that, but rather reacting well and then coping to that feeling appropriately, whatever that means for you,
right?
Right? So as opposed to doing a number of things, punching someone in the face or driving off a cliff, whatever the thing is, right? Don't do that. Whatever the coping skills are for you to sort of navigate your way out of that negative emotion would be mental health, right?
Right.
And so I think, again, that's why I led with, I have a solid sense of self and a good sense of self-awareness such that I can react, I think, appropriately to any situation that arises. And I know how to live with that feeling for a period of time, but not let it overwhelm me or determine my personhood, if that makes sense.
No, that totally makes sense. You're 100% right. Complete happiness is delusional.
Right.
So yeah, it's not reality based.
Of course.
So that's the wrong target.
Right.
And B, do you meditate?
I do meditate in my own way. We all meditate differently, of course,
right.
if you meditate at all. So a couple of things. Physical fitness is a big thing for me. I went to the gym this morning at 4:45 in the morning. I'm on a schedule. I'm on a routine, and I will say the meditation in part is, it comes from the routine part of my life,
right?
So having some things that are standard, that are given, that are constant, really helped to give me some stability and clarity,
right?
Because I know they're just gonna be there, right?
Yep.
So that is very helpful for me. And actually, when I'm working out, I'm meditating in a sense, mm-hmm. right? That is one of the ways I meditate. I also I'm very ritualistic, for what it's worth. I don't want to sound too creepy to people, but for example, whenever I do any sort of communicating, speaking, even like this, I wear a certain set of jewelry just because it sort of just helps me focus on that task.
That's not creepy at all. I'm a musician, so when I play out, I wear the same clothes all the time.
Yes,
and I have to sit on the same stool, and I get it.
So things like that, though, it's not quite meditation, but it is sort of creating. It's creating conditions in your life that allow for familiarity and comfort.
It's mindset creation.
It's mindset creation. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I think the mindset creation allows for you to be aware, open, vigilant about how you're feeling, what's happening in the world around you, what's happening in your local environment here.
Yeah.
And so those are some of the things that I do to meditate. I do also I sit in my room and I sit in my house and I sort of just sort of think random thoughts. I have these notebooks that I have that I write things down in. Actually, one of the ways I meditate is back to the comment about gratitude. I had a jar in my house, and it's sort of in my built-in china cabinet, if you will. And I just carry around with me most days a set of index cards. And when there are things that happen to me that I feel particularly grateful for. I just write it on the note card.
That is
and
so
I put
cool.
It, and I put it in the jar. And I do that at least, I try to do it in the moment, but if I don't do it in the moment, I do it at least once a week to try to capture yep. that week's moments that I might forget if I don't do it at yeah. that time. And I just put it in the jar and I revisit it throughout the year, you know, halfway through the year, at the end of the year, when New Year's comes. And for me, that is meditation.
That's brilliant meditation. I do. Yeah. I handwrite 3 pages every morning. But to your point about gratitude, so I use composition notebooks because I blow through them so right. much. Like I was spending $40 a month on notebooks. I'm like, all right, let's dial that back.
Yes.
But part of what I do is I take like a credit card for every day and I trace around the credit card and I have to fill it with things I'm grateful for.
Oh, wow.
And it's part of my daily.
Oh, I love that. So yeah. It's a very similar practice.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
But you're more mentally disciplined than I am, so you can do it once a week and still get benefit. If I don't do it like every day, I'm like,
argh. I just don't want to lose it. I mean, and yeah. there are things that happen that are so beautiful in my life that I'm very grateful for. And I want to remember them.
Right.
The year is very long. And thankfully for me, lots of things happen in my year. And so I want to be able to document that in a way that is sustainable, in ways that I can revisit. And so it's a great practice for me.
You're less digital than I thought you would be. You're a paper and pen and index card guy.
It's funny. Yes, I'm an old soul. I've always been an old soul.
Yep.
So it's funny. I call myself an old soul. No. I have... how do I say it? I change how I say it, but I basically have an old soul, but have adolescent spirits too, right? I'm a very playful person and I'm a very youthful and excited and adventurous person, but I can be very old souled as well, which I love. I love technology and I'm not a Luddite at all. I love technology and find lots of benefits and opportunities for amazing things to happen via technology, right? I mean, I go to Rwanda relatively often, but I'm not going every month. I go maybe once or twice a year. And in that in-between time, I'm communicating with my colleagues in Rwanda via WhatsApp, via Instagram, whatever, right? And so having that connection, I think, is magical and very important. I'm one of the folks actually who many of my colleagues are surprised. I work hybrid for my job, and I'm gone a lot, whether it's in Florida or traveling for work. And my assessment, you have to ask others, my assessment is I work just as fine remote as I do in person, right? Because I am of an era where I grew up with technology in the way we have it now, right? And so it feels very natural to me, and I feel like it is possible, and I, in my own life, have created a community via technology in ways that folks who might be of a different generation may not feel, you know, the same ease to do, right? And so I love technology, but I do love paper and pen. I have, it might be in my bag today, I carry around personalized stationery, actually, with my name on it.
We are so alike, it's ridiculous.
Let me see if I have it.
All right.
Cool. I really do love paper and pen and writing things down, and it just feels very real. It feels very unadulterated, if you will, and it feels like people I know appreciate having things that are handwritten and, you know, it's like a relic.
I have a theory. Tell me what you think.
Yes.
I think that our...
Another notebook.
Nice.
Another notebook, yes.
I think that the quality of our thinking has suffered as we handwrite less.
Yes.
And less. Because handwriting has... Oh, that's cool. Handwriting has a tempo to it.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
I always have some of my stationery with me wherever I go.
I love that, man. thinking has a tempo.
Yes.
Good thinking has a tempo.
Yes.
And like you said before, even like emotional thinking, that you can live with something for a while and then decide how you're going to respond. That's a tempo.
Yes.
That's a pace. Communication has a tempo.
Absolutely.
As we type more and handwrite less, we increase that tempo. As we increase that tempo, as with anything that goes faster, you start missing things. When I'm songwriting, I do it by hand because it forces me to think about every word and the even what's happening in between the words. And I think overall, the quality of our thoughts declines the less we handwrite.
Yes, it's so true. I think it's true. I even when I host our Ambassador podcast and I take a lot of pride in preparing really meaningfully for the guests that are to come. And I read their books, I read their articles, I study what they talk about so I can be fluent in what we're discussing. And as I prepare, I keep tons of notes. And it's funny because my process sort of goes from a huge catchment area of things, so to speak, and I funnel, of course, up into the morning before the conversation. And I funnel from, you know, I don't have any with me now, but like it'll be from a variety of sticky notes or highlighted things or scratch notes or even notes in my phone or whatever. And so that's sort of the whole supermarket of things that I start with once I've done my first round of preparation. And then I start to think, to your point, how do I thematically put these things together in ways that make for a cogent conversation? And so I think about that, I write those themes down, and then I start to actually place some of the sticky notes or thoughts into buckets, right? That's on like one sheet of paper, and then I have a particular piece of paper. It's not that stationery, but it's a different stationery.
This is really cool, by the way.
thank you. On a different stationery, I put my final notes for our conversation. And it's funny because I have it's a foldable sort of hard stock piece of paper. I do six, not quadrants, obviously, but six sections on the thing. And I sort of do an intro for the person in the first section. And then the last section is a student hot seat question sort of panel. And in between, I sort of have it sectioned in different ways. But I'm very ritualistic about these things. But it's very funny how all these thoughts ultimately go into a very sort of singular, clean piece of written notes.
Yes.
That I often never look at, to be honest with you. I often never refer to them during our conversations.
Because
process of doing it that makes me not have to look at it.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. So I did this. No, it's because you hand wrote it.
Yes.
You don't have. I did this thing last in April
okay.
of this year, and we're doing it again next year, called the Lifted Project.
Okay.
And so my wife had head and neck cancer, right? And and she had like this crazy treatment. It was hellacious.
How is she?
She's good now.
Okay.
But she had this amazing listener. You can fast forward if you've heard the story before. She had this incredible recovery story.
Yeah.
Because she had her head basically cut off and her face burned off, and it was just god awful. But then she met a person. When you get that kind of treatment and you're done, they just basically they show you out the door and you're left. And she couldn't walk. She had neuropathy. She couldn't talk. And she met this trainer who took her from shame. Like, she didn't want to leave the house. She was disfigured too. Jumping on these 2-foot blocks. From not walking to jumping on 2-foot blocks.
Wow.
Over the course of 3 months, just through this amazing.
Oh, it's quick.
Oh, it's insane. It was amazing to watch. All through this journey of love and trust.
Wow.
It was incredible. And so I saw her do that. And then now she's better. So now I do what any husband does, and I watch TV.
Right.
And I'm watching the We Are the World doc. It's true. I'm watching the We Are the World documentary.
Okay.
And I'm like, hey, dummy. You, because of your show, you have access to like this league of amazingly talented musicians.
Yeah.
Why don't you do something? So this goes to the handwriting thing.
Yeah.
So we did this Lifted Project thing, which is I wrote a song and I got 38 musicians together and nobody rehearsed it.
Oh, wow.
And we sold out the Hudson Valley Airport, and so I packed them so there would be pressure. And they just basically watched us run through the
oh
song until
gosh.
We got good at it. And we had like four nonprofit partners, and
cool.
they had visibility there.
Yeah.
But the idea was to do it without raising any money. Like
right.
the idea was just to lift the energy
right.
and the money would come.
Come
to the yes. to those charities.
Yes.
So I decided I'm gonna do it again this year. I may hit up Vassar Choir, actually.
Yeah,
I decided I'm gonna do it again this year, right? So I go back to my notebooks. It was one song. It took me three composition notebooks to write that one song.
Really?
Yeah. And I look back, I'm like, how crazy that is.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Isn't that? It's a beautiful story.
Oh, thank
And the process is, of course, like where the actual beauty is.
Yeah.
Like what had to happen to get there is really where the magic is.
And so I wrote a song for it, and I
play it for my wife. And she's like, that's horrible. You can't do that. So one and a half of those notebooks was the bad song.
But you have to get through that to get to what the end product was. Yeah, so it's okay. Yeah.
Do you do anything creative other than, I mean, I think academia is creative, but.
Yeah. You know, I think I'm an incredibly creative. I've always thought I'm an incredibly creative person. That's kind of you to say. My card stock for, or my personalization name, for those who can't see or those who are listening, is my full name, which is Wesley Eugene Dixon. I love my full name because Eugene is actually my father's middle name. Mm. People don't know that. His first name is actually William, but his father's name was William, and so they called him Gene or Eugene, and people don't know that's not his first name. They think that's his actual first name. But so anyway, so I have my my dad's middle name as my middle name because my grandfather, my dad had the same name. So I have a very, there's lots of cool things about my name. Yeah. And then there's a flamingo on it. And flamingos are special to me. It's not really at all because I'm from Florida. They happen to be in Florida a lot, but that's not why. Flamingos, I think, they project an energy of balance to them. And of course, if you've seen flamingos, you often recognize they stand on one leg most of the time. They don't stand on both of their legs, but their other leg is often tucked in or bent up, but they're standing on one leg most of the time. And so they have this great sort of spirit of balance with
them. What a cool way to think of that.
And so that, I think, is something that I have always tried to embody and think I do embody. And at the same time, flamingos in a group. So multiple flamingos, you know, there's funny words for this, right? Like the school of fish or whatever, right? Flamingos, the group for multiple flamingos is a flamboyance of flamingos. That's sort of the word.
That's a little perfect.
And so, I think it's wonderful because I do think I have a very flamboyant personality, but I balance that with the balance of a flamingo as well, too. And so flamingos for me have always been a very special sort of, one might call it a spirit animal, if you will, but I love them and they're beautiful and they are mean. So that's what's on my stationery.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
Do you write?
Creatively,
not academically. Yeah,
it's a good question. Not in any sort of formal way, but I am often writing in different ways, right? Whether it's, little short stories or we wouldn't call them poems, but just short expository sorts of writing in my phone. When things come to me, I just like to write them down. Or when I'm having an experience and I reflect on it, I might actually write the reflection out as opposed to just sort of thinking it myself. And in some ways, that becomes a creative writing process for me. So I think I'm a really creative person.
Because you have that energy. Like, you have the energy that you could probably write something really good.
That's very nice of you to say. It's funny because when I was growing up, in elementary school, middle school, I struggled a lot in language arts and English. As a matter of fact, I told myself growing up that I was not an English person. I was a math and science person. I do love math and science, but I told myself that I just wasn't an English person.
Right.
And I am now old enough to recognize that's not true at all. In fact, I love language. I love literature. I love communication. Obviously, all that is language. And I just don't think I was in an environment that sort of gave me the right tools or sort of gave me the right kind of support to think that I was a language communications English person at that time. Right. Now that I'm older, I recognize that I am. And so I think there was a period of my life where I probably was underdeveloped or underinvested in that way, just because I told myself and was told that that was not my strong suit, if you will. Or maybe I grew into it, who knows? But but now I love creativity, particularly around literature and prose and speaking and writing.
You should take a swing at it.
Yeah, that's kind of you to say.
Yeah, you should take a swing.
I will.
You have that. You have you have the energy of somebody that, like I said, that who could write something really good.
I love hearing you say that, and I take pride in the fact that I think I often will listen to the messages that are for me from other people that I never would have told myself, right? I think it's true that people who are not you can see things in you that you can't see in yourself, right?
Totally.
And so it's not lost on me that we met today, but you've made this very kind and I think authentic comment about what you see in me. And so I will take it to heart and I will think about how to act on it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you think part of your balance is your, like I have a crazy mental health journey.
Okay.
I was nuts.
Okay.
And on 7 different medications.
Okay.
And suicidal.
Okay.
And had to walk myself through it all and went cold turkey and now have like this practice where
love that.
Where I'm clear.
Right.
But it's and so I know a bit about mental instability,
right,
and mental disease.
Yeah.
And one of the things why I say I think you would be like a really good writer if you did it. One of the things you used the phrase a couple times that you take pride in something. Only clear mentally healthy people can do that.
Mm.
And I that's something that I couldn't do for the longest time and still struggle with. I'm still not super good at it.
Right.
Because it's hard to, like, you do it authentically. When I do it, it sounds like I'm bragging. But when you do it, it's authentic because of your flamingo, because you're balanced. So I think that's really cool. That's why I think you would be able to write. You seem perched exactly where you're. Sorry, no pun. Perched exactly where you're.
Well, you know, I like to think again. I think part of this comes from me being an only child. I think not every only child, I think, develops this, but it's possible for you to develop it as an only child. I think it's very easy and natural for me to be in something, to be in a group, to be in a community, to be part of a team, but also have the vantage point of an observer, right?
Yeah.
So to be in something, but to be able to still view something as if you were on the outside, but to be in it.
Now you're Buddhist.
I think is something that that I've been able to do.
Right.
And so I think it makes it really easy to see a range of truths or see a range of realities when you're able to be in it, but also see from outside it, right?
Right.
And so I think that makes for interesting storytelling. You pick up on the things that happen that may be missed otherwise,
yep.
The things that are actually making things tick and making things go. And so I love that. I mean, I think you are interviewing me, which I had to restrain myself because I wanted to ask you
some
questions. But I love doing the podcast ambassador and being a storyteller in that way, because I do feel like there are ways in which I can make a story of someone where they didn't see one that existed
right.
in themselves.
Right. Right?
And I like to ask questions in a compassionate way, but that pull out things from someone they may not have known
mm-hmm.
or articulated for themselves, right? And sort
right.
of see how that has other implications. And so I feel like maybe that you're right. Maybe that does make for a good author, storyteller,
yeah.
journalist, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But I love what I'm doing, and I'm grateful to have been in a role at Vassar that has allowed me to take on this body work as part of my overall body of work.
Yep.
It's not my primary job, but it's a really special part of my job.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just grateful to be at a place and have a supervisor and a team that supports me in doing that.
Do you have kids?
I don't have kids, but I want to have kids.
When you do.
Yes.
Like the one, when I started doing the show, one yeah. thing I didn't consider was that I'm leaving like a digital legacy.
Yeah.
Like my 8,000 notebooks will probably get moldy and die, but I'm leaving like a digital legacy.
Yes.
And it makes you think about, because you're a host, it makes you think about your work in a different way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, now my daughter can hear what I think about like too many things.
Yeah.
But where are you spiritually? Do you have a spiritual practice? What's your because you were Buddhist there for a second with the observing. Well, you were Buddhist in not reacting.
Yeah.
That's a Buddhist tenet.
Yeah.
And you were Buddhist in detachment and observation as
yeah.
opposed to, so are you're not Buddhist.
Well, I don't want to say I'm not Buddhist. I've never thought about whether I'm Buddhist or not.
Okay.
and it's possible that I have Buddhist tendencies.
That listener is the answer, a smart guy.
Is you know, I have never thought about it. Let me back up. Let me tell my story of how I've grown up spiritually. I grew up with two parents. So I'm from Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
Which I would not say is culturally the South. It is South Florida, but it's not really the South culturally per se. My parents are culturally from the South. My dad's from Kentucky. My mom's from Mississippi. And that's where my family is from. And so many of them still live in both places today. And I love that. I'm not, no disrespect to any listeners, I'm not sort of a Northern elite apologist. I see lots of value in the South, despite what I think is the really easy comments that people make about the South, whether it's that it's backward, that it's slow, people are uneducated, people are stupid, whatever the things are, those things are unpleasant to my ear because I know them not to be true.
Right.
And because of just my own lived experience. So that aside, I grew up going to church all the time. I went to church in Fort Lauderdale, and it was a non-denominational Christian church. And I would say it probably had a it probably had a Southern Baptist bend to it, but it was a non-denominational church.
Right.
And I will tell you, that was one of the most positive experiences of my life. And to this day, many aspects of my church experience are still active and alive in me today. I have some of my closest friends in life are people who I met in church. Some of my sort of adopted family or chosen family of fake aunts and uncles, whoever else, are people who I met in church. My home pastor, Pastor Wayne Lomax, who I'll send this to when it's published, he is my only pastor. I was baptized in his church. I've never really been a member of another church. Despite not living in Fort Lauderdale full-time for a long time, I've not joined another church besides the Fountain of New Life Church in Pembroke Pines, Florida. And I think that's meaningful. He and I still have a very wonderful relationship, one that I think is not only pastor and member or shepherd and sheep or whatever other analogy, but as people.
Right.
And he knows me for my full self. I know him for his full self. There's no sort of there's no pretense around our relationship. And so because of those things, I have a very positive relationship with my particular upbringing in my church. I recognize full well that not everyone has the same story to tell, and I don't mean to diminish those. I'm just speaking about my story and my experience in my church,
right,
which has been very positive. Part of that story, though, is that I think I grew up in a church environment with, whether it's parents or church members, or particularly Pastor Lomax or others, who I think have a very non-absolutist approach to how they think about spirituality, religion, and church, right? And so I think there are experiences that I've had in my own life that I won't talk about here in detail, but that might seem to fly in the face of a particular dogmatic view of whatever Judeo-Christian religion, right? But I think whether it's I created the space myself or Pastor Lomax did or others did, there's space in my own life, in my own spiritual bucket, for a range of different kinds of experiences, beliefs, and practices, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think to answer your question, where I am spiritually is I am a person who was born and raised in a non-denominational Christian church, who has a huge appetite for a range of spiritual practices and beliefs, all with the hope of learning and living a life that is pleasing to others. Others, I really don't mean other people, but to sort of, in a broad sense, pleasing to sort of an overseer, if you
right.
will, and in a way that creates love and peace and happiness and connections and joy as the end goal.
You were raised right.
My parents did a wonderful job. I love them to death. They will get this copy of this podcast too, and I think they did do a wonderful job raising me. Absolutely.
Yeah. I've been obsessed with that question lately of, because I part of me getting better mentally was like a Buddhist Buddhist meditation practice, and the idea of because I was brought up in a church too, and actually was going to be a pastor at one point, but So then I studied Buddhism to get better, and I'm like, okay, well, wait. Christianity makes sense. Buddhism makes sense.
Yeah.
And those are really the only two that I have like a working
right.
knowledge of.
Right.
But I'm willing to bet
right.
if those two make sense, there's probably others that make sense. And I think and I'm opposite you in my church experience. I've been to I belong to like four churches,
right?
And almost none of them were helpful. Some of the people were super
of
great,
of course.
But you know what triangulation is in relationships?
Yes.
For me, church has been that. It's like it's not a direct relationship with God or whatever,
right?
But kind of a third party.
Yes.
That plays
sure
mediator there.
Sure.
And I wasn't as good at it as you are.
No, I mean, it's always a work in progress. And I think, you know, life is sometimes the best teacher, right?
Yeah.
And I think life will force you or encourage you to evaluate things differently in ways that will get you to a different conclusion than you might have already assumed you might get to, right?
Right.
And so I think I am cognizant of the fact that I hopefully and prayerfully have much more life to live, and recognize that within that, I might shift different spiritual practices or beliefs or ways of approaching things based on what life presents me with in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And I'm okay with that.
Right.
I do think, though, what I am grateful for is that I have a foundation in my church from which I can build from.
You can speak the language.
Yes, that is very helpful. I found it to be very helpful to have a foundation that I can say, okay, if I do want to get some clarity or get some insight on something, or feel like I want some language or something, I know where I can go to get that.
You have that muscle to flex.
Exactly. That I think makes it very easy for me to reach to other, I'll put it like this, I'm not open to other spiritual practices or beliefs because I'm lacking one,
right?
I'm open to them, in fact, because I have one.
Right.
That grounds me, right? And
that
so it makes
sense.
It very easy for me to add to that.
Yeah.
I'm not lost looking for something. I'm just trying to add more feathers to my cap, so
right.
to speak, by adding other things to my spiritual practice.
I had a medium on the show, and she contacts people who have passed. And I had her on the show, and I was skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were done, she said, listen, come to my house. I'm going to do a reading for you, and I'm going to do a reading for you and then see what you think. So I said okay, and she did the reading, and it, like, some of it was, oh, that's good,
okay,
but some of it is, well, you might have done your research.
Okay.
So I'm like, so then we get done.
Yeah,
my daughter's name is Gramercy.
Oh, I love that name.
Oh, thanks. It means it's French for a big thank you.
I love that name.
I wish it was more strategic than that. But no, my wife and I were in the city, and we were at Gramercy Tavern. We're like, hey, if we ever do have a kid, that's kind of a cool
Gramercy.
Name.
Gramercy. Yeah. I love that.
Oh, thanks. And so she's a senior in high school this year, and she wants to go to the Bahamas on a senior trip.
Okay.
See, thank you. Unchaperoned.
Look at you all.
Yeah, well. and there's a company that does it.
Okay.
And so the company gets mixed reviews, but everybody in her school district goes.
Okay.
So we were talking about this, just me and her and her mom.
You and your grandma say, okay.
Yeah. And nobody else knew about this.
Okay.
No, there was no way for anybody else to know about this.
I got you.
We're in her the foyer of her house, and she's like, can I get a picture with you? And I'm like, sure. So she takes a picture, and she goes, and not a lot of people know my daughter's name either, because when I write about her online, I call her the package, which is a whole other story. It doesn't mean what it's a whole other story.
Got you.
And she goes, Gramercy?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. And she goes, Bahamas? And I go, yeah. And she goes, don't worry about it. She'll be fine. That freaked me out. And
of
I'm like, okay,
did.
200 years ago, you would be a witch and I would be burning you.
Yes.
And today, you're making me feel better about something. So,
yes.
Yeah, spirituality is a spectrum.
It's a spectrum.
And
yes.
Where are you with mediums? Do you?
I have a medium, yes.
Oh, you do?
I do, yes.
What's it like to, how do you manage that relationship? Like, is it like a doctor where you like go for a physical or?
I've never thought about it that way. I think that is how I think about it. That's how I manage it.
Okay.
A doctor is a perfect analogy. I've never heard that. I've never crossed my mind to think about it that way. But yes, I try to go to her once a year,
mm-hmm.
at minimum, as you would for an annual physical, whatever. But then there are times where I'm like, huh, I kind of feel like I want to see her. So then I go to her.
Okay.
As if I had some sort of, I don't want to say ailment, but if I had some sort of thing that I wanted to look at that was acute,
right?
I would say, oh, like, let me go to her. And so I'm very fond of her. She's amazing. I've known her for my whole life, but didn't know that she was a medium until several years ago.
Right.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I think I would benefit from that.
Yeah. I've enjoyed it. She is wonderful, and she she's just wonderful.
That's cool.
That's all I'll say. She's wonderful.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Pick a number.
Within.
We did.
Oh, still 1 to 10.
1, 3, 7, and we covered climate change. So
let's do 8.
8. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh, what is it?
Goodness. I'm lucky I'm with the smart guy.
Oh.
Corruption and governance issues. Corruption undermines trust in institutions, erodes democracy, and stifles economic growth.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. Corruption is really tough. And I think the source of corruption, all these things that you've mentioned are all related, I think, right? I think corruption often comes from inequality, yep. right? And I think when people feel like there's no opportunity for them to be able to do well of their own, right? They resort to things that are akin to corruption,
right?
Right. And so I think, so I would say it two ways. I think preventing corruption is one effort. I think tackling corruption that's already there is a different effort,
right?
Right. I think preventing corruption is doing what we talked about earlier. I think that is creating conditions where people can live healthily, wholly, happily in their environment, right? Such that there's no need to be corrupt. Mm-hmm. There's no easy need to be corrupt,
right?
Right, because you know and have confidence in the fact that you can accomplish a certain amount of things, live a certain kind of life, have certain basic needs taken care of. There's no need to be corrupt, right? if you know those things can and will happen,
right?
I think addressing corruption is very difficult. I think addressing corruption, I mean, it's sort of like a cancer. You have to just get it out, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's very difficult because I think that can feel and seem like a scorch the earth sort of mentality, right? Because mm-hmm. sometimes it does require that, right? To sort of take everything down and begin again and begin anew, mm-hmm. right? But I think, and I should say, not that I've been a sort of a statecrafter, but I would say it might have, the question is whether or not you scorch the earth in piecemeal or you scorch
the earth
at one time, right? I think that is the real question, right? And I think in leadership, I've learned one of the things that the president of Astor, I think, does very well, she is very attentive to the pace of change, right? Because change, of course, is germane to leadership. But I think where some people in leadership roles fall short is that they have not quite gotten the right pace of change. They're either too slow or too quick, yep. right? And I think you want to be somewhere in between.
Right.
And so I think relative to the issue of corruption, I think it's a relevant but difficult question to answer in terms of what the pace of sort of netting out corruption should mm-hmm. be. But I think that would be my thought on it.
So higher education.
Yeah.
Politically.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah,
higher education politically sways left.
Yeah.
And the argument against that is that you're indoctrinating, not you personally, but that higher education is indoctrinating left.
Yeah.
My response to that is if a group of really smart people all seem to think a certain way, we don't argue when the same group of smart people thinks gravity works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
we don't have a problem with that. So we're not fighting them when they're indoctrinating people into gravity.
Right.
But why isn't that point? Why isn't my point? Why isn't my point of view obvious?
Yeah. So a couple things. I think higher education, particularly a liberal arts higher education,
right.
or those types of educational models, they feel very. What I was going to say was they feel very risky. That's actually not what I really mean. What I mean is, let me say it differently. When you're living in an environment like we are now, arguably in this country, that is teetering on fascism, right? Or dictatorship, right? The kind of higher education that we're talking about, I think, is seen as a threat to the attempt to create a fascist sort of environment,
okay.
right?
Yep.
And so I think it becomes very strategically helpful to demonize higher education in the way that you are parroting those who do it.
Right.
That's a very strategic thing that they do mm-hmm. to say, yeah, the source of knowledge that we have come heretofore to assume is the source of knowledge or a source of knowledge, it's illegitimate. It's not authentic. They're crazy over there because that I think allows the fascist-esque kind of person mm-hmm. to start to gain more power, more resources, more market share of the mind, if you will, because you've delegitimized legitimate inquiry.
Yeah.
Right? So I think my point is it's not an accident that people don't hear your logic because they don't want to hear your logic. It's not self-serving for people who want to create or live in a dictatorship or a fascist sort of society, right?
Right.
It's too, it's why in other societies around the world, there is less free press. There is less things that are akin to First Amendment rights, right? Because those things allow for the kinds of true inquiry and debate that exist in a higher education space like Vassar or other liberal arts colleges, right? But those things are threats to folks who want to control the narrative and in purport there is a singular narrative, mm-hmm. right? One of the things that I think is so great about Vassar, and I think of all schools that are like Vassar, is that there is actually incredibly diverse thought on our campuses, mm-hmm. right? It might skew left, so to speak, but when you peel the onion back, we have students from all over the country, all over the world. The president just told me the other day she met with a student who's from a small place called Synthonia, Kentucky, where she grew up going to revivals and tents and whatever else, right? Mm. And she's at Vassar, right? Wow. She might be a left-thinking person now, right? But she has experience and perspective and reference points of folks who might be, quote unquote, more right, right? And right. she brings that to her experiences in her classrooms at Vassar, right? Despite her own personal perspectives, she has the encyclopedia, lived encyclopedia of folks who are different than the leftist train of thought, if you will, right? And so I don't think those stories or those realities are often acknowledged when we think about higher education, because it is true. They have students who have the whole gamut of thoughts on a whole gamut of issues, mm-hmm. right? And so I say that because I think if, I'll say it like this, if it was the case that students at places like Vassar were so singly minded and we're all of one mind, right? It would not be a hard task every day to of me and my colleagues to maintain a healthy, dynamic living and learning community at Vassar, right? Because they all be the same,
right?
But our jobs are hard. We're often thinking about how to maintain a campus that is able to maintain in a container, you know, that's stable. All these thoughts, opinions, ideas, we work very hard at that. And so we work hard at it because it's not a singular place,
right?
And I don't think that's the narrative, to your point, that people have about higher education in this country.
You worried about AI?
I'm excited about AI.
I like you. There you go.
I'm excited about AI. I think AI is something that the worry, of course, is that there are things that should be considered as we continue to go into an AI fill society, right? There are all kinds of potential pitfalls and landmines, right? Of course, data is not apolitical. Data is it can be a very biased thing, right? How we collect data, how we interpret data is not sort of just a sort of black or white zero one variable. That's not what it is, right? That's research has shown that. So there are things to be considered about AI, right? That could be, if used incorrectly or used carelessly, harmful. I'm excited because I work at a place like Vassar where our students are being trained in a broad range of liberal arts ways of thinking with broad disciplinary expertise, whether that's humanities, history, psychology, computer science, biology, such that when those people, our students, our graduates, are living in an AI-led or influenced world, they have the humanistic rudder to be able to direct AI in the way that's most helpful, most productive, and least harmful for our society. So the combination of those things is very exciting to me.
That's awesome. That's a fantastic way to think about it.
Yeah.
I think it drives us to universal basic income, which I'm for.
It could do that.
And here's why I'm for that. Because the argument against me is it's not a meritocracy and you're taking away people's ability. Universal basic income has the word basic in it.
Right.
It's the floor.
Right.
You don't have
your
to stand on
your
the
fundamentals
dirt.
Are covered. Taken care of.
Right,
yes.
right.
Yes.
Now you have the opportunity to explore sides of you that most people don't have the opportunity to explore.
Right.
Maybe you do love doing the same, hitting the same nail with the same hammer all day. Maybe you love that. It doesn't take away the choice
of
doing
that. You don't have to do that because you have no other choice.
Right.
Right.
But if you like to do that,
then you can keep doing it. Right.
And I think, because the big fear of AI is jobs. It takes away jobs. I'm like, well, yes, it might take away some jobs, but we have
every time we've developed a technology, because AI is not our first technology.
Of course, of course.
Cars didn't destroy horses.
Right, of course, so, of course. Yes, I think
we'll figure it out.
To your point, I think new things, AI being the example we're talking about now, I think creates opportunities for creativity, innovation, and new ways of living.
Yeah.
Right? That's just the truth. And for some people, and I know this is a privileged thing to say, it could be exciting to see that happen,
right?
Right? When your station in life is such that you're likely to be the person who is forced to have to think through that creativity and not see it from a distance, yeah. It's harder to see it with a positive lens, right?
So I
get that.
If I'm a truck driver, I'm not a fan right now.
Correct. Or a longshoreman.
Right.
Right? I understand that. And so I'm sympathetic to people who have a different orientation to AI based on how their life is right now. And I hope that as people start to incorporate AI into their business practices, they bring those quote unquote people along and make them or encourage them or show them how and why AI can be a part of their life in a way that's not disruptive, but generative for them.
You ever think about running for office?
Listen,
no.
lots of things have crossed my mind at some point in time. Whether they stay there or not is a different story, but things have crossed my mind. It has not stayed, but listen, as I said, I am humble enough to know that life will bring me things that I haven't anticipated.
Yeah.
And I am curious enough to know, or curious enough to explore those things when they present themselves, if they present themselves, whatever they may be.
If I could talk you into it someday, you'd be really good at it. When you're done with the novel.
What kind of
finish
office?
The novel.
Let me ask you, what kind of office do you think I should run for?
President.
Oh my goodness, please.
No.
Now I know this is all a crock of BS.
And no. Yeah, no. Here's why. Here's why. I think the problem with the office of the presidency,
yes,
is that it's been knocked off of its fulcrum. And you're the balance guy.
I try to be.
Yeah. So your spiritual outlook is, I know what I know, and I'm also open to what I don't know, and
correct.
I think more than one thing works.
Correct.
Your spirit animal stands on one leg. You're open to. And what you just said, I'm humble enough to know that stuff's going to happen that I don't understand. That's perspective that we need right at the top. Instead of, I have the plan, I know what I'm doing, and this is – and I wish somebody would run on that, that take. I don't know. I don't know. You don't know. You don't know either. It's not about knowing. It's about managing as we experience.
Absolutely. And I try to live my life that way. I'm a very adventurous person within reason, obviously. But I like adventure because I like having to I like adventure and I like new experiences. And I tell young people this, I talk to all the time. I'm a yes person. When someone says to me, hey, do you want to go do insert – whatever thing I've never done before, I'm oftentimes going to say yes because I like to have a new experience by which I can bounce my life off of and think about things a little differently based on that new experience, right? And say, right. Oh, I had never thought about either this line of work, not for myself, but I've never experienced what someone who does this is like or what they think about it, what their concerns are, whatever it is, right? And
right.
So I think that is why I like to have these adventurous spirits because I learn the most from sort of attracting or seeking adventure broadly defined. And I will say running for president absolutely does not appeal to me, but I do think having a role, and there's many roles that it could be.
Mm-hmm.
There could be many kinds of roles, but living a life that allows me at some point to have a role where I am able to influence community. I don't mean influence in a nefarious way, but I mean to convene, to listen, to synthesize, to create with people new opportunities, to connect people across communities, organizations, thoughts, ideas, or whatever, to be in a role that allows me to do that day to day, would be a dream for me. That might be politics. It might not be.
Right.
But to have that be my impact and to that be what I do is what I am excited about. And the title that is attributed to can be many things. No, it could be no title at all, frankly.
Right.
Right. But to do that side of that sort of work is what animates me every day.
Mm. You're a good guy.
I try to be. I really try to be.
The podcast is Conversations
at the Salt Line. Yes. Line.
And where do I hear it?
You can hear it anywhere. You can hear it on iTunes, on Spotify, Google Play, or whatever. All the different podcast platforms you can find it on.
Okay. And are you doing anything else?
That's it for now. I'm always open to other kinds of opportunities, either at Vassar or outside of Vassar, that are exciting storytelling, communications, convening kinds of things. I just love this. Again, this is one of my very few times talking about myself, frankly. I oftentimes like to talk to others, and I might then tell stories about myself in reference to what they're saying, but really it's not about me, it's about them. I love doing that. I really love creating a space where I can talk to people, learn from people, help others learn from people, and create new thoughts with someone else with our time together. So I'm open to ways that we do that. I love stories. I love humanity. I love humanity that creates beautiful stories. I love complex stories. The best stories are not the ones that are the best packaged or have a clear end or clear beginning. So I love gritty, messy, exciting stories about people. I've kind of always wanted to do something that was like the audio version of Humans of New York.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much sort of the spirit of what I want my own personal outside of Vassar creative project to be.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it starts here. We'll see. But
I was going to say, co-host with me or do a show here. I produce shows here.
That might be what's up next. So, who knows?
Beautiful, man.
Yeah. You are incredible.
Oh,
you are an amazing host.
I don't know about that. Thank you.
You are. Oh. No, you absolutely are. And it's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
And to have gotten the invite. I don't know what I did to deserve that, but it's. I'm happy that whatever it was brought me here with you today.
Me too. And I'm sorry for bombarding you with the world's issues.
No. It makes me think. And I should say, part of the humility is I might recognize in 10 days that I might have a different answer to those
right.
questions because I've learned something else. Or someone told me, Wes, think about this. And I'm happy to have that happen too. So, but
that's why you should be president.
But regardless of what is in my future, I'm happy about the right now.
Good.
With you on this podcast, in my life at Vassar, in my role at Vassar, everything is hitting on all cylinders. It makes me feel very good, and I'm happy about
that. Awesome. Well, thank you for bringing positivity.
Of course.
Can I take your picture?
Absolutely. Beautiful. Absolutely.
Listener, you have to listen to me take Wesley's picture. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all for listening. I'm sure I sound crazy at parts of the podcast, so if that's the case, just write it off to, I don't know, Spooky October, but...
Okay, but my show's different than your show.
Okay.
My show's about crazy, and I'm crazy.
So I might feel a little bit normal, quote-unquote, to some of the folks listening, compared to who's been on in the past.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, very, very much so.
I promise you there's more texture to me than what I said today, but maybe on a different episode we can talk about some of those
things. Well, we still got five more. You got to come back because we got five,
five more issues we have to solve.
Where do you stand on using the word crazy?
I'm not.
I get flack on both sides.
I got you. I'm not a purist. I'm not perfect, and I'm not a purist. I probably use crazy in ways sometimes that are disrespectful of those who have legitimate mental illnesses, and I understand that, and I can do better about using it more thoughtfully. At the same time, communication is an art, and when I'm talking to people, depending on who they are, and we use the word crazy, we know what each other means. We mean no harm by it. The intent is not to be hurtful, and hopefully I don't harm anyone who hears it who wasn't intended to hear it. So that's where I stand.
Well, I was crazy, and I describe myself as having been crazy.
Right.
And I get flack for it. And my argument back is the biggest hindrance to mental health isn't the disease. It's fear of it.
Yeah.
If I can't call it what it is,
yeah.
I'm afraid of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the first step is, look,
acknowledgement.
I know what you are.
Right.
I had a panic attack. 2 days ago.
Okay.
I get like three a year. They're not a big deal.
I had like a
big one.
Yeah.
And so yesterday I burned it out in the gym for 3 hours to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I went hard. And
I realize, and I feel better. And I realize, like, the first step of that is when I was having it, I'm like, oh, wait, I know what you are.
You knew what was going on. Right, exactly.
I know who you are.
Right.
And I know how to handle you.
Yeah, you have coping skills.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the word crazy. I know what that is.
Yep.
I'm not afraid of it. And so I will call it what it is.
Absolutely.
I really hope you come back.
I'm happy to be back. Let me know when you want me back.
Monday.
We'll find a time.
All right. Beautiful, man. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much.
This was really fun.
This is incredible.
All right, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was home from here. Bye, guys.
Bye.